This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to The Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and today we have with us Shinsen Young. And we're going to discuss the topic of meditation. How are you, Shinsen?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
So tell me something. How did you get on the path that you're on? I mean, normally something terrible has to happen in someone's life to take them to the path that you're on. Did you have that happen to you?
Well, not exactly, but sort of. It started for me when I was pretty young in L.A. I grew up in Los Angeles, and my best friend in junior high school was third-generation Japanese-American. And this is way back there. I mean, I was, like, born in 1944, so we were actually still fighting Japan. So anyway, he was my best friend in school, and his family used to go see Japanese movies every Friday night, so they invited me to go see a Japanese movie, which I was not interested in, but I didn't want to make them feel bad. So it turned out it was a samurai movie. I was about 14 at the time, and I was just absolutely galvanized, mesmerized by this martial arts thing. And so I started to go to with this family to see these Japanese movies every week, and then they started to teach me Japanese, and then I found out that there's a whole alternate language school system for Japanese-American kids in L.A. that meets like after regular public school. So I started to go to Japanese school. So by the time I graduated from Venice High, I also graduated from Sawtelle Japanese Language Institute, and I had grown up bilingual and bicultural, so I was very fortunate. And my interests in Buddhism were originally just cultural, but I did want to study it because it was part of traditional Japanese culture, and I was fascinated with all of traditional Japanese culture. So what started me out was more of an intellectual interest, I would say. But then various things happened, and that turned into a practical interest in terms of what it could do for me.
How did it change your life?
Well, what happened was after I graduated from high school, I went to UCLA, and I took a major in Asian languages. And then I wanted to go to graduate school. So, as I mentioned, I was interested in all facets of Asian culture. So it was suggested that I might go to the University of Wisconsin because they had a PhD program in Buddhist studies, and they emphasized knowledge of Asian languages, and I, by that time, had acquired more than just Japanese. I had acquired several Asian languages, so I thought, oh, I'll go and study Buddhism academically. So I was able to complete my coursework very quickly, and they for the PhD, and they sent me to Japan in order to research a certain school of Japanese Buddhism. That's it's called Shingon, S-H-I-N-G-O-N, and that's essentially the Japanese equivalent of Vajrayana practice, V-A-J-R-A-Y-A-N-A. That's the form of practice that's prevalent in Tibet, but the Japanese have their version of it, and no Westerner had ever studied it. So I thought, well, you know, I'll study this. It'll be my academic specialty. But when I got there, they didn't want to have anything to do with me because I just had an intellectual curiosity. And for them, this was a life-transforming path. So basically, you know, they said, you can either become a Buddhist monk and practice this in order to transform your life, or forget about it. We're not going to teach you anything, just so that you can have, you know, some intellectual one-upmanship on other people. Mm-hmm. So I decided to give it a try. And in terms of how it changed my life, I would say that up until then, I did not have very good concentration power. Like most people, my attention got easily scattered. One of the first things I noticed as the result of meditation is a growth in my concentration power. And at first it was rather subtle. You know, I'd sit there for an hour counting my breath. And at the end of the period, I would notice that, you know, I had settled in. The voice of my thoughts was not screaming in my head quite as loud. When my attention wandered, I could bring it back. And it felt really good. And I'd never experienced anything like that in my entire life. I didn't even know that that was possible, to have a state where your attention is focused in a laser-like way. And then I started to notice that it wasn't just during those periods of formal practice. I would start to go into those concentrated states during ordinary activities. And
it's consciously or being aware of it?
It would happen spontaneously as the result of the formal practice, and then I would also be able to intentionally do it. So now I had a way of, like, it was of getting, in a sense, a kind of high whenever I wanted. I could just enter this state that it wasn't just something that affected the mind, but it also affected the body. I would become very relaxed, reposed, and my attention would stay on whatever I wanted to focus it on. And it was like this huge change in my life, because now I would get bored, I would feel I was wasting my time. Now I had this secret little thing that I could do anytime I wanted, just enter these states of high concentration. And it just grew and grew and grew. Now, why concentration power is important is that I consider concentration, one's base level of concentration, to be the single most generic and powerful skill a person can have. So here's what I mean. Generic means applies to all things. Once you have the ability to concentrate, that will improve your intellectual skills, that will improve your sports skills, that will improve your social skills, that will improve your artistic skills, that will improve your self-knowledge skills, that will deepen your prayer life, that will deepen your sex life, okay? You name it. There's no human endeavor that doesn't go better, and there's no human activity that isn't more effective when you do it in a concentrated state. So the thing about concentration power is it's not like what can you use it for. The question is what can't you use it for? Any endeavor, any other skill that you might want to achieve, is predicated on your base level of concentration. So just like in the sciences, physics is at the base of the physical sciences, but mathematics is at the base of physics, even deeper and broader. So what's deeper and broader than mathematics is concentration power, because you can apply it to anything, including becoming a better mathematician. So with once I had this, this was like a huge discovery. It's like, whoa, every single thing that I would ever want to do, I can now do in a more joyous, effective way, because I have permanently elevated my concentration power. Now, my definition of concentration power, I try to be very precise in my language. Concentration power I define as the ability to focus on what is relevant and let go of what is irrelevant in a given situation for as long as you want, any time you want. That's my definition of concentration power. So I would say the first impact that I noticed in my life was first during formal practice, and then spreading into daily life and deepening, was that I was more present and focused in all my activities. And I sometimes tell people, there's no way that I can add 100 years to your life. But what I can do as a meditation teacher is teach you how to be 2 or 3 times as present in each moment of your life. And if you're 2 or 3 times as present as the average human being would be, then even if you only live 50 years, you have lived the equivalent in terms of richness of 150 years. So that's we can't add a lot onto a life, but we can expand the scale of the life by developing habitual concentration power. And that was, I would say, the first epiphany and the first major rewiring of me as a human being that occurred due to a formal meditation practice.
Now, before you started this, were you aware of the spiritual implications that were available, or did you just kind of approach it as something that you had an interest in researching in?
It was more intellectual. In fact, I rather was skeptical about the spiritual dimension of things, I would say.
Most people are.
Yeah, it was initially a cultural interest. Then when I started to sort of like discover that there was this natural legal high called samadhi, that was like, whoa, that was experiential. But it was not yet quite what I would call spiritual. But that came about later as a natural unfolding.
Can you describe that? Because so many people don't, including myself, don't know how to really get, it takes me a while to get into that state, altered state of mind. So many people have never experienced, they can't still the mind long enough to even get close. So can you describe that process for them, how it felt and how long it took and how it changed you?
You're referring to the concentration power or?
The spiritual side of it.
The spiritual side of things. Well, see, the concentration is not necessarily a spiritual experience. It's sort of like, how do you direct the concentration, which will determine if it's a spiritual experience. So after I started to get a little bit of concentration power, my teacher in Japan pointed out that that in and of itself is very good, but that's not really where it's at, so to speak. where it's at is actually something beyond mere concentration power. As hard as it is to get concentration power, the goal of Buddhist practice and broadly of spiritual practice is beyond just being in a concentrated state. So how do you then go from merely having high concentration to having an actual spiritual experience is what you're asking. Mm-hmm. So actually, it has to do with using the concentration power like a microscope in order to observe your subjective experience and gain insight into your spiritual nature. For example, the metaphor that I use is if I were to ask you, does your hand consist of billions of little invisible cells? You would answer yes. If I were to ask you, how do you know? You could answer in one of two ways. You could say, well, my high school biology book said it so, and I believe it. Or you could say, I looked through a microscope, and I saw that it's so. Mm-hmm. Now, the only reason you'd believe the high school biology book is because at some point, somebody looked through a microscope, whether it was you or the author, and saw that it is so. Now, a microscope does not change physical reality. All it does is magnify and resolve. Resolution power means the ability to separate out things that the naked eye cannot separate. That's mainly what a microscope does. It's not so much the magnification factor, it's the resolution factor, the pulling apart of points that for the naked eye fall together. The microscope is able to separate them out, and therefore you can see the fine structure of the physical world. Concentration power could be used in many ways. One of them is to use it like a microscope and to turn it towards the experience of self, of your own I am-ness.
Now, I have a question here. For people that can't grasp that, how do they know what they're looking for?
They probably are going to need a competent teacher. I don't believe in a surrendering to a guru. I don't think you have to find the perfect master or even confine yourself to studying with one person or one tradition. But although in theory you might be able to do this on your own, in practice, it's like learning how to play the piano. You probably are going to need somebody to sit down with you and just sort of show you a couple of things. So when I work with people, I give them systematic exercises so that they can tease apart the experience of self, and the idea being that if you look at it at a fine enough level, microscopically, you'll be able to directly discover the spiritual nature of self. You don't have to try to believe it, just like you don't have to believe that the cells are there just because somebody tells you in a book. You can actually get a microscope and see for yourself, because you know that the microscope does nothing but resolve, in other words, make clear what's there. So concentration doesn't change anything, but it can make clear what's there. So to make it a little more tangible, if you were studying with me, what I would have you do is moment by moment monitor whether you were having thoughts in mental images or whether you were having thoughts in internal talk or whether you were having emotional type sensations in your body. We'd start broadly breaking up your experience of self into what I call feel, which is emotional sensations in the body, image, which is visual thinking, and talk, what I call talk for internal talk, which is auditory thinking. At any given instant, if you have no mental pictures, no internal talk, and no emotional sensations in your body, your mental screen is blank, your head is quiet, and your body is emotionally peaceful. If that were to happen, you would have very little sense of a limited self. On the other hand, if you look carefully, you'll notice whenever a sense of personal identity arises within you, it depends on, or there is always some level of activation in either feel and or image and or talk. So therefore, the sense of self arises when you have these kinds of sensory activities. Now, if you break up the sense of self into those components, that's a beginning. Then you carefully observe each one of those components. You remember my metaphor that under the microscope, the hand goes away and the cells arise. Under the microscope of high concentration, emotional sensations, mental images, and internal talk go away, and the spiritual vibrating void, which is what they're really made of, becomes evident. So that you can actually use the concentration to look at such a fine scale of your sense of self that the sense of self literally, not because you believe it or want it to be so, not because of pie in the sky or wishful thinking, but before your very eyes, your sense of limited identity dissolves into an unlimited flow of energy.
Mm-hmm. So how long does it take to get from a place where you have racing thoughts in your mind to where you can just bring it about at any given moment? Assuming that you practice what you need to do.
Yeah, assuming that you do practice and that you have some competent instruction. Obviously different for different people. But I would say if you put in it's a combination of three things. Doing a little practice each day, maybe a half an hour. Getting instruction from somebody who's competent, and then doing intensive retreats. Without periods of intensive practice, which could be a half day or a whole weekend or a whole week or a month or whatever, without periods of silent intensive practice, if you just do a day-to-day, there's less likelihood of success. The most successful people are the ones that can allocate at least something like a half an hour a day for formal practice. And then maybe once a month they do a half day retreat, or, you know, every once a month they do a whole day, or every couple months they do a whole day, or a couple times a year they do a week, something like that. And they keep that regimen going. I would say there's a lot of variation between people, obviously. But if you do day-to-day practice and periodic retreat practice, and you have contact with a competent coach, that within a couple years, 2, 3, 4 years, you should be noticing pretty dramatic increase in your concentration and sense of restfulness.
I would imagine being able to reach a state of mind like that could do tremendous things if you have some kind of serious illness. Have you had experience with that with any of your students or yourself?
Well,
imagine you could direct thought so intensely that you could heal your body.
Certainly.
With direct intention.
Yes. Certainly it cannot be a bad thing, okay, apropos of, you know, your physical health. However, I should point out that usually within the Buddhist tradition, one doesn't do this practice with the specific goal that it will benefit objective health. That's not the goal. That's, how shall I say, a side effect that might happen. Because the goal is actually a deeper and subtler goal than merely being healthy. The goal is not suffering. So one way to reduce suffering is to reduce illness. Another way to reduce suffering is to be able to experience illness in a way that it's not a problem. Because sooner or later, something's going to get you. Even the Buddha, you know, eventually got sick and died. So the trick is to be able to experience the physical and emotional discomfort of illness in a way that it does not cause suffering and, in fact, is part of the perfection of the moment. That's actually a more important goal than merely being healthy. Not to say that being healthy isn't important. But there's limits as to how healthy any physical body is ever going to be. Sooner or later, they deteriorate.
Yeah, that's interesting how that your response there, because most people that I interview would probably go off in a different direction with that question.
Well, yes, because they are trying to get people interested in what I would call the path of power as opposed to the path of insight. Mm-hmm. That sure. Both of these have a role in spirituality, for sure, but the powers of consciousness are what tend to attract people. But the source of consciousness is the more mature goal, but that's not so attractive because it's a little hard to understand, to wrap your concept around initially. It's like anybody can understand, oh, if I meditate, it'll improve my health. And it might, to some extent, or maybe not. It's a little harder to understand that if I meditate, I'll go beyond health and illness, beyond duality, beyond inside and outside, beyond pleasure and pain, beyond God and the devil. It's like, what the hell does that mean?
Do you have the belief systems of non-duality?
Well, I wouldn't say I have a belief system. I would say I have experience.
I believe in non-duality. At least that's
yeah.
As I try to.
The way I would formulate my experience is in a non-duality point of view.
So, You brought up the word consciousness, and one thing that I'm doing right now is some interviews about what is it, because I found interviewing all of these intellectuals on consciousness, when I say, what is your definition of consciousness, no matter who it is, whether it's Bill Tiller or Dean Radin or whoever it is, I get a different answer. What is consciousness to you? What is your definition?
Well, you might get a different answer from me, too. I'd be interested to know if anybody you interviewed gave an answer like what I give. My answer is I don't know what consciousness is.
So how do you...
But I know a lot of things about consciousness. I just don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to define it. Now, that might seem a little strange, but if you talk to a physicist and you ask them, what's electromagnetism, what's light, what's matter, what's energy, they'll likely say, well, you know, I can't really define it, I don't really know what it is, but I can tell you a lot of things about it.
Right, right.
And if you, I will guarantee you, if you talk to a mathematician and ask, and mathematicians are the most careful about their language, and you ask, what's a point, what's a line, what's a set, what does it mean to be a member of a set? If you ask the basic concepts in mathematics for definitions, they will actually tell you, you know what, we don't define that. We don't even attempt to define it. But we can tell you a lot of consequences, a lot of things that are valid about it, even though we don't define it. So I cannot define consciousness. I do not attempt to define consciousness. And actually, as shocking as this may seem, I'm not all that concerned with what consciousness is. I mean, I'd sort of like to know, but it's not a big deal for me. What is a big deal, though, is there are all sorts of things that, in my experience, are true and useful and maybe not obvious that can be said about consciousness. So I can tell you things that are true, useful, and deep about consciousness, but I can't tell you what consciousness is.
Okay, fair enough. I understand. I've been trying to get some kind of change in the linguistics so that at least everybody's on the same page. A doctor told me one time that when I asked him, it was the opposite of being in a coma, and I realized then that we were far from being on the same page in the use of that word. So
that's interesting, isn't it?
Yes,
although,
it is.
You know what? You might not like to hear this, but that would be, if I had to give a definition, that would probably be where I would start. I'm not particularly a fan of consciousness. I don't think it's I think it's overrated. That may sound very strange to you. But from the Buddhist perspective, they say there's matter and there's consciousness. And one isn't any better than the other. They're both just places where people get attached and where their identity gets limited. The idea is to go beyond both matter and consciousness. Enlightenment is beyond consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. I had an experience one time, and the only way I know how to describe it was I had some kind of spontaneous enlightenment one time, and it felt like how you feel when you have an orgasm without the sex part attached. Does that make any sense to you?
It makes total sense. I completely understand what you're saying.
It was
wonderful.
A quivering and some kind of unity, for lack of a better word, or lack thereof. I mean, it was like I didn't exist anymore, and it had this quivering, vibrating thing, and it lasted for several weeks, and it felt like I was walking about 6 inches up off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a sort of mini enlightenment experience. That's exactly what I was describing when I said you see the vibrating void nature of your subjective self and of everything.
It was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
Congratulations. That's really good.
I wish I could bring it into my life every moment, you know.
You can. Just do a little more meditation.
So
there's no reason you can't go back to that. People come to my programs, and I'm sure other teachers frequently have had that kind of experience spontaneously. And then they want to know a way to get back there. And see, it's not so much a matter of getting back there. It's really a matter of working through what prevents that experience. That experience is actually available always, but we have certain deep-seated habits of consciousness that get in the way of that. It's not so much the goal of spiritual practice, as I would see it, is not so much to somehow get to that experience. It's to gradually work through what prevents that experience, and then that experience will be present automatically all the time.
Why do you think it happens to people spontaneous like that? When it happened to me, I wasn't seeking. I didn't know there was anything to seek. I was just living my life one day, and in the blink of an eye, it just happened. Why does that happen to people like that, do you suppose?
I do not know, and I would like to know. Okay? As I said, I'm not so excited about what is consciousness, but it would be very exciting for me to know why it is that some people have spontaneous, albeit perhaps transient, enlightenment experiences. I do not know. I don't have a clue. I just know it happens. Typically, however, if it happens without previous practice, that person doesn't have a context, they don't have enough concentration power to hold it, they don't have a conceptual context within which to put it, and when the old, they don't have equanimity, which is a kind of detachment, so when the old habit forces return, they re-identify, and they sort of go back to the way they were before, but not entirely, because they still have this memory, and it informs the rest of their life as it has for you. So that's really wonderful. If after practice, after you have a lot of concentration power, if that experience happens spontaneously, you can hold on to it. You just direct your concentration power to that place, and when the old habits start to reassert themselves, you have some degree of detachment, and you also have a conceptual framework to put it in from your spiritual practice. So if that very same experience were to happen to you after many years of formal meditation, it wouldn't just pass. It wouldn't fade. It would be where you would live from that time on. But the fact that it's happened once means it can happen again. There's no reason that you can't work through what prevents that and live there 24/7.
I'm going to have to come to one of your satsangs. I really am going to have to do that.
Well, me or somebody like me that pushes people in that direction.
Do you find when you get there that you have greater access to knowledge? Do you
yes.
have drop downs of knowledge that come in?
There's a we call
sense?
It.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Does it make sense? I mean, do you know? Does that what I'm saying? Drop downs of knowledge.
Yes, we call it prajna, P-R-A-J-N-Y-A. It's a kind of new kind of knowing that arises in that person, a kind of wisdom function. That's why mindfulness meditation, which is the tradition I teach in, is sometimes called insight meditation, because you get these epiphanies and it activates this wisdom function. Yes, you definitely experience the classic spontaneous sort of, you know, mini hit.
Did it change your psychic abilities? Because it made me psychic. I wasn't psychic before, and suddenly.
Well, remember I said there's a relationship between the realms of there's the realms of power, and then there's the realms of insight, and these are both part of the path. Some people have the powers, but they don't have the insight. Some people have the insight, but they don't have the powers. Some people have both, and most people have neither. And different teachers have different specialties. My specialty is more the insight side of things. I'm not particularly aware of, I haven't put much time or effort, let's put it that way, into exploring the powers. Some things have happened, but to be blunt, I mean, you know, like entities and deities and other lives.
I'm
not
interested
in that either. Well, I've experienced it all. But it's not very interesting to me, relative to the work of plummeting the source of it all. But see, the powers and the realms of power and the sort of New Age wish list of whatever, all that, the healing powers, the psychic powers, the telekinesis powers, the, you know, psi, you name it, whatever, former lives leaving your body, etc., etc., etc. All of those, that's all what I call the realm of powers. The realm of powers, and then there's the realm of where most people live, ordinary experience, you know, the practical workaday world where most people live. But you see, both the world of the humdrum and the world of the powerful and unusual, both the world of the banal and the world of the bizarre, they all come from the same source, which is a kind of nothing whatsoeverness. And once your sights are directed towards the source, also known in some traditions as God, the humdrum of daily life and the most intense psychic abilities pretty much look the same. They're equally important or equally unimportant. But it's all within a different context once you realize where it all comes from.
Did it change your interest in remaining in physical reality?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by remaining in physical reality. It could mean different things to different people.
Yeah, I guess so. Did it change your interest in what's going on around you and participating in physical reality?
Yeah, it increased my interest in physical reality.
Because a lot of people that do that get, I guess, what I call out there on the edge, where they don't want to participate anymore. They get reclusive. And
yeah, that's spiritual teenager. Spiritual teenager wants to get away from unspiritual. A spiritual adult is attracted to the material world. Once you understand your source, you understand everybody's source, so you have to care about everybody. You have to serve. You have to be involved and engaged.
So you don't take the position that there's no thing to fix?
Well, I would not disagree with that position. I cannot disagree with that position.
Well, I kind of say there's no thing to fix, but we can make the ride a roller coaster with glee and laughter, or ride with that roller coaster enclosed in a haunted house. Do you feel kind of that? Do you know what I mean by that? We can make it fun or miserable. We can do kind things or put forth positive energy into the world, which affects the mass consciousness, or we can sit back in our cave and do nothing and just let it go. We can make a difference, I believe.
I would agree with that.
So, in other words, there is no thing to fix, but we can contribute to it being a better place, because it does contribute, I believe.
The trick is to really, really, really realize there's no thing to fix. And, you know, that can be a sort of feel-good concept, but to really realize there's no thing to fix, when, you know, you get a root canal, or you've got a hemorrhoid, or your best friend betrays you.
Or war.
Or you have to live in a time when, you know, the wrong people are in power. To really realize in those times that there's nothing to fix is an extraordinary attainment. It means you don't suffer.
How do you explain it to a fundamentalist? If you were having a conversation with a fundamentalist and you're trying to explain to them why there's no thing to fix,
I would never try to explain that to a fundamentalist.
Of course, but assume we're talking, because many of the listeners probably are that way, and they have no idea what we're talking about. How would you explain that?
Well, I wouldn't engage in a conversation
of course not,
with people that is going to annoy them or be inscrutable to them. But
you don't have to engage now. You just have to simply state it, so maybe something will click and they'll understand. I understand, but then the other people are just listening. They can't dialogue with you, you know?
Yeah. I don't, remember I said I can't disagree with the statement?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say that I actively teach that statement.
Mm-hmm. So?
Well, if I had to say why, I would agree with that statement. Let me give you an example. In Buddhism, they have this expression, the ordinary mind is the way. Way with a capital W. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that means like your ordinary everyday mind, things just as they are, is like the ultimate spiritual reality. So there's nothing to fix, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
So then, that sounds good, it feels good, but what the heck does it mean? Here's how I would put it into words, if I had to put it into words. If you think what ordinary mind is, well, it scatters here, it scatters there, then it obsesses on this, then it obsesses on that, then it scatters here, it scatters there, goes here, goes there, then obsesses on this, then obsesses on that. And what is the ordinary body? you have a discomfort and you, like, get real fixated on where that one discomfort is, but then that discomfort spreads and inundates over your whole body, okay, and then some other uncomfortable place arises, and you get preoccupied with that itch or that pressure, but then you realize it's like everywhere over your whole body, subtly, you know, the tension, the reactions spread. So the ordinary mind goes here, goes there, scattered all over creation. And when it's not scattered, it's like fixated and obsessing. The ordinary body, you're pulled to this pleasure, you're pulled to that pain. And when you're not fixated on a particular piece of your body, you're where your whole body is calling your attention, calling your attention. And it's like constantly doing this. So that's the experience of the ordinary body and the ordinary mind. In what possible way could this be described as cosmic truth? Well, consider the following. We could take a point of view that there are two sides to the spirit, one called yin, the other called yang, one called negation, limiting, pulling in, the other called affirmation, unlimiting, spreading out. When you observe the vagaries of your body-mind experience carefully, you realize that the scattering is really just the expansive side of nature. And the obsession and fixation, what you interpret as being caught, as being tight, as being dense, is just the contractive side of nature. Really, there's no problem at all. It's just space, expanding and contracting. From that perspective, ordinary experience is the cosmic way, and there's absolutely nothing to fix.
I agree. Well, we've got just a couple of more minutes, so I'd like for you to tell people where they can find you.
Go to my website, www.shinzen.org. And there's more than a book's worth of free articles. If they want to do retreats with me, they can look in the article section. If they want to send me an email about learning how to meditate, they can send an email to that site.
And what is that site?
Huh?
What is that site?
It's the Vipassana Support International website. That's my organization, VSI, Vipassana Support International. And so that site has my writings and other things related to my teaching. www.shinzen.org.
And that's shinzen.org?
That is correct.
Good. Listen, I have to tell you, sometimes when I get people on to talk about meditation, I kind of dread it because they say, I get to talking about it and they say, well, you just be still and quiet and it changes your life. Well, how do you do that? Well, you just sit there and be still and be quiet. But this has been a great interview. I loved it. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's
been my pleasure.
You had a lot more to say than that. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Very good.
I appreciate it. I hope you'll come back sometime. Agape,
okay.
My friend.
Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Have a good evening.
You too.
And to all your listeners, you folks have a good evening too.